Welcome to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal. This is Michel Chossadovsky. The Global Research News Hour is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. On today's program, we will be welcoming later in the hour Representative Denis Kucinich, who will be joining us directly from his constituency in Ohio. And we also have with us a collaborator and long-time analyst, historian of the United States, involved in promoting progressive politics in America. It's Michael Carmichael. He has worked in several U.S. presidential campaigns for progressive candidates, including RFK, Eugene McCarthy, Hubert Humphrey, George McGovern, Lloyd Benson, Jimmy Carter, and most recently Denis Kucinich. So he is joining us now, and in about half an hour we will be welcoming our guest Denis Kucinich, who will be focusing on the articles of impeachment which he introduced in the House of Representatives, and also I think a very critical piece of legislation which has passed virtually unnoticed, and it consists in the changes to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act passed in the House of Representatives on July 9th, in other words, last week. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michel. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have worked with Denis Kucinich on his campaign when he was running for president, and you know his thought train, and I mean he's an absolutely fabulous speaker, committed right from the beginning of his career when he was involved in municipal politics in Cleveland, Ohio. How would you describe Denis Kucinich?
Well, I would describe him certainly as one of America's leading progressive politicians. He has a flawless record, a lifelong career of support for progressive issues. Of course, there has been evolution in his personal positions since his career has been so long. He is a very bold and courageous politician. Above all, I think that the term courage is an inspiring one to use when discussing Kucinich. The first volume of his autobiography was published last year, titled The Courage to Survive, and that is about his very humble beginnings in Cleveland, where he was born unto a working-class family. His father was a union member of the Teamsters Union, and they had a large family of seven children. He was the eldest of the seven children, and he explains in very Dickensian detail, in the first person, of course, his life in Cleveland for the first 20 or 21 years. And believe you me, he faced challenges which it's hard to conceive that Americans would face challenges such as those confronting Denis Kucinich and his family from the 1940s. He was born in 1946. And the family was poor. The father was a veteran of World War II, where he had served in combat missions. But when he returned, the post-war economy was such that it was difficult to find work. He was frequently without employment, and this meant that in those circumstances, the family never owned their own home. They only were able to rent properties that were very small, and when the family grew, it was necessary for them to keep moving, and in some cases, actually to disguise the fact that they had one or two or three or more children. And Denis tells a very heartbreaking story that he can recall from the time he was 3 or 4 years of age, his parents saying, the landlord is about to come around and we can't let him know that we have so many children, so you go out and hide. So yeah. I mean, These are heartbreaking stories that shaped Dennis and gave him a grasp on the problems confronting poor people in America that literally very, very few members of Congress or the members of the United States Senate or presidents have ever had the insight and the direct personal experience.
I think as you describe him as a man of tremendous courage but courage which is articulated in a political context. I mean, from a Canadian perspective, when we listen to Denis Kucinich in his relentless battle to introduce the articles of impeachment, I see a consistent thread. Is that not? I mean, right from the beginning, when I believe he was elected to the Cleveland City Council at age 23, and then he became mayor at age 31. Well, most people just are finishing graduate school at that time.
Exactly. And some of these early political experiences are recounted in his in his personal autobiography, the one I've told you, although it ends at the age of 21 or 22, because in spite of all of these economic and other psychological crises that he was facing as the oldest of seven children in a very poor family, he internalized all of the emotional content of his life, and he ended up with a very serious illness. And he had to survive a very extreme and painful surgical procedure quite early in his 20s before proceeding on to doing his graduate work in Cleveland and then going into politics. And he ran for office more than one time. He was inspired by the challenges faced in his childhood to make changes, to bring about changes in American culture through government and politics. And so, you know, he has the classical motivations of a champion and hero of the working class and the poor.
And in Congress, he was also very active in sponsoring legislation which protected working Americans, in other words, in the areas of health, social security, improvements in infrastructure, the death penalty. I mean, the whole series of legislative initiatives which he took, and then in the post 9/11 period, he was of course concerned with the U.S. Patriot Act and how to repeal it, as well as the much broader issue of addressing the criminalization. I think that's the correct term, the criminalization of the U.S. administration, namely the fact that the Bush administration has waged an illegal war and has deceived the American people and has deceived Congress. And that brings me to the articles of impeachment. So you have followed the debate in terms of these articles of impeachment. How do you view his latest initiative?
Well, I think it's marvelous. I think that the latest initiative, I presume you mean his introduction of a one definitive article of impeachment. That's great. It was in fact the first point, the first article in his original bill of impeachment, which was, of course, the point that the U.S. government was misled into the war in Iraq deliberately by the president. And this is one of the most serious charges, of course, ever lodged in the history of the United States against a president. If we look at the history of impeachment, it isn't really all that lengthy. This is a rarely invoked procedure. It's only two sitting presidents have ever been formally impeached, and those were, you know, Andrew Johnson in the 1860s, and that was simply for the violation of the Tenure of Office Act. Basically, it was purely a political drive to drive him out of the presidency or to disempower his presidency, which failed by only one vote in the Senate, by the way. He was impeached in the House and tried in the Senate. They failed to convict him by only one vote, a very, you know, the narrowest, the thinnest of all outcomes. And then the second time was, of course, articles of impeachment were being entered and discussed in the during the Watergate period, and when Richard Nixon found out about those, and when he faced the reality, he had a reality check with the leaders of the Senate and of the House, and he discovered that, you know, he was going to be impeached and he would be convicted. So he avoided impeachment in name only by resigning immediately. And the third case would, of course, be Bill Clinton. When that's recent enough that most people probably listening to this broadcast will have some recollection of that. I mean, that was simply a political process concerning, you know, his testimony in a private lawsuit.
But in essence, I mean, if we compare to previous impeachments, George W. Bush should have been impeached a long time ago, because essentially, well, there was an active impeachment procedure against Bill Clinton for an affair with an intern and having lied regarding his sex life.
Exactly.
Now here we're dealing with a president and commander in chief who has launched an illegal war, who has repealed the U.S. Constitution, which is involved in supporting acts of torture, rendition, in other words, crimes against humanity, who is now introducing legislation to spy on American citizens. I mean, these 35 articles of impeachment really describe in very much detail all the misdemeanors which are committed by the Bush administration and specifically by Bush and Cheney. And if you compare that to Nixon, or you compare that to Clinton, of course, it's kind of a double standard situation, right? Because Clinton was being accused of something which in effect is quite trivial. Certainly doesn't affect it was really a Republican cabal directed against him, but here we're dealing with something quite different.
Absolutely right, Michelle. There's a qualitative difference between the cases of Bill Clinton and George Bush Jr. In Clinton's case, I mean, the legalistic argument would be that he committed perjury as a result of, you know, his testimony in the Paula Jones lawsuit. Okay, I think that's, you know, and the articles of impeachment call for impeachment under the high crimes and misdemeanors. Well, it certainly wasn't a high crime. It could be construed as a misdemeanor, although perjury is considered to be a felony. But in this case, it's, you know, trivialized because of the content of the situation.
Well, but he lied about his sex life.
Under oath.
That's really what he lied about. He didn't lie about Iraq or about bombing a country. He lied about lots of people lie about their, you know, about their adulterous
personal
affairs. Okay?
Yes, of course.
And now, I mean, these articles of impeachment are, if one reads them very carefully, one comes up with, of course, a devastating balance sheet of this administration. Perhaps it's useful to mention that the articles of impeachment, there were 35 articles of impeachment which were introduced, and then they were sidetracked. They weren't supported by Nancy Pelosi, who is the majority leader of the House. And it was, I think, as a result of this sidetracking and lack of support by lead Democrats that Dennis Kucinich introduced a single article of impeachment. Presumably, he had some kind of an agreement with his party, and this one article reads. Points to the fact that the President of the United States deceived Congress with fabricated threats of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to fraudulently obtain authorization for use of military force and, of course, launch a war on false pretense. So it's the act of misleading the U.S. Congress, which he put forth in this last and single article of impeachment. Is that correct?
Well, yes. In fact, it was article number one of his original bill of impeachment, and the title of that is Creating a Secret Propaganda Campaign to Manufacture a False Case for War Against Iraq. And you know, this is really, Article 2 was illustrative of the same content of Article 1. It says, falsely, systematically, and with criminal intent, conflating the attacks of September 11, 2001, with misrepresentation of Iraq as a security threat, as part of fraudulent justification for a war of aggression. And he went, the other articles, you know, you went on to that to say that the Bush government misled the American people and members of Congress to believe Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction to manufacture a false case for war. These are very serious charges that no previous sitting president of the United States has ever faced charges of this magnitude. This is one of the most important historical documents of this period, because it will define the case against the entire Bush era. And you're absolutely right. At the very essence of this is the manipulation of secret propaganda campaigns to manufacture public support and political support within the United States Congress and among the American people for unjust wars. And that is...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it's just it occurred to me, Michael, that the single article that now he's introducing is that was Article 3 of what he submitted in June, which reads, misleading the American people and members of Congress to believe Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction to manufacture false case for war. Is it the same text as that, or is it a different, slightly differently worded text?
Well, you know, I'm on the website right now, and I don't even find a PDF of the current bill. I've got it somewhere on my computer. But yes, I mean the first three titles that I just read you, I mean they're all contained in that. The first four points of the first four articles are condensed into one point now. That basically that the Bush government manufactured a false case for war against Iraq, and that in and of itself constitutes an impeachable offense. And I believe that there is a general consensus in America that a false case against Iraq was indeed manufactured. I mean, the entire world is more than well aware of that, since now over 5 years after the initial American invasion and the continuous occupation of Iraq, there have been no weapons of mass destruction discovered. So this is precisely the basis of Denis Kucinich's articles of impeachment in his current pleadings on behalf of impeachment. And the other thing is important is that if Bush isn't impeached for on charges this serious, and Clinton was, and before him Andrew Johnson was, then when will Congress ever act again in the future? I mean, is this in fact decriminalizing high crimes and misdemeanors inside the United States of America? Will the presidency move into a period when it is beyond impeachment? Will there be no legal parameters that will constrain the acts of the president of the United States? And this is why people in America are dismayed at the handling of the impeachment legislation by not only Nancy Pelosi, who's the Speaker of the House, but also Steny Hoyer and others in the United States Congress, who believe that the political impact of this debate on the American nation would transfix the public and somehow or another be detrimental to what? I don't know. I don't understand. I don't think that they've made a very clear explanation for their... For their positions on this particular issue. Now, it's from the standpoint of Barack Obama, who is the presumptive Democratic nominee who will stand against John McCain, the hand-picked successor to George Bush. I can understand why, you know, he he might want to project his own message on with a completely different agenda. But that doesn't address, though, the problem of how do we, as Americans, continue to constrain a presidency which has become openly criminal in so many dimensions of its policies. And that is why this original bill by Denis Kucinich is such an extremely valuable historical document.
Well, I think it's a valuable historical document because even if it does not achieve the impeachment of George W. Bush within his present term of office, which, I mean, in any event, is highly unlikely because of the total timing of legislation. But I think what it does is that it sets the historical record. It writes history, so to speak, because I think we have to be very careful that history has to be on record. The history of the Bush administration and the crimes committed by the Bush administration. And I think at the same time, what's happening is that with the repeal of the rule of law, the manipulation of the judicial system, the changes in the FISA legislation, the Patriot Act, that in effect, that history is, what they want to do is to rewrite the history of the U.S. Constitution, so to speak, and cover up the war crimes that are being committed, cover up the crimes which the Bush administration has and continues to commit. So I think it's a very important initiative, I suspect that the Bush administration is also reacting more broadly, and that the recent FISA legislation, which passed in the House on the 9th of July, just a few days ago, that in a sense is a response to these initiatives. I'm not saying necessarily Denis Kucinich's initiative per se, but the fact that Americans are very much aware of where the country is moving, both in its domestic policy as well as in its foreign policy.
That's absolutely correct, Michel. I noticed that in the initial bill of impeachment that Article 25 was directing telecommunications companies to create an illegal and unconstitutional database of the private telephone numbers and emails of American citizens. Well, of course, FISA goes well beyond that. And I really like your language when you say that America is moving in a very dangerous direction. That's exactly what's taking place.
Those are the words of Denis Kucinich. He says they're drifting. It was a statement he made in the U.S. Congress on the 13th of March, where he said that the United States is drifting towards a national security state. He said it quite very clearly in a very articulate way. And I think that people across America realize this, and are seeking ways and means to break the consensus and the legitimacy of this administration.
Absolutely.
It's a bit like the Spanish Inquisition. Although hopefully it won't last 400 years like the Spanish Inquisition.
Let's hope not, but who knows? I mean, we who knows what will happen in 400 years' time? I think the world will be a very different place than the one we know. Technology and politics will, you know, converge, and there will be, you know, new levels of government invasion of the privacy and the rights of citizens. So Denis is very very bold, very courageous to consolidate this record of high crimes. I don't see any misdemeanors in this original document of the 35, and the greatest one being, perhaps the greatest crime a president could commit would be to lead a nation into a war on a secret agenda, and that's basically what is being said. That there is no case left for the war in Iraq under the original bill of indictment of Iraq, so to speak. That there was, in fact, another agenda that was operating, and as we all saw, we all witnessed the kaleidoscope effect taking place after the launch of the war in Iraq. We were going there to prevent another terrorist attack on the United States, launched by this time a nation state instead of a secret multinational organization like Al Qaeda. It was, in fact, to prevent a nuclear attack on the United States or a biological or biochemical attack on the United States. It was could have been launched, we were told, within 45 minutes. And when, after several months and more of diligent searching throughout Iraq, by a procedure in and of itself that was extremely costly for the American taxpayers, that nothing, no evidence of any kind was ever found that could have substantiated those reports. So there was a secret agenda for the war in Iraq, and it's obviously that's probably the highest crime that any person could commit, any president could possibly commit. The oath of office that the president takes, it's clear, by the way, that George Bush does not understand the oath of office. He doesn't understand the Constitution of the United States. He doesn't understand the history of the United States. He doesn't understand the presidency of the United States. That the highest crime that a president can commit is, of course, failing to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that's why your concerns about FISA are so important and so cogent and so apposite.
But then we can ask the question, he doesn't understand. But then you've got hundreds, perhaps thousands of other people within his entourage in the U.S. Congress who don't understand it either, because how is it that that this agenda, from this post 9/11 agenda of invading Iraq and Afghanistan, and now preparing for the next phase of this war, which is Iran, also on false pretense, how is it that the U.S. Congress is in fact complicit? We're not strictly dealing with George W. Bush as a single decision maker. We're dealing with a whole process, a whole political process. So some people have said, well, is Nancy Pelosi also, is she responsible because she is not pushing forth a peace agenda against the Bush administration?
These are very good questions, and of course you're right that Bush is not alone in failing to understand the Constitution or the presidency of the United States or the history and culture of American government. That others, members of Congress, many of them, and members of the United States Senate, and of course let's point out that the entire Republican Party has been led into this cul-de-sac, this historical cul-de-sac of a failure to defend the Constitution of the United States time after time after time again, and that Bush is unique in American history because no president has ever attacked the Constitution as aggressively, as systematically, and as consistently as he has. And you're absolutely correct. It isn't Bush acting alone. He is surrounded by a coterie of lackeys who are just as content as he is to attack and to shred whole portions and sectors of the Constitution of the United States in violation of his oath of office.
But that's also true for the Democrats, because after all they control the House, the U.S. Congress.
Well, they do and they don't, because they don't have the veto-proof majority in the United States Senate.
That's correct.
It's one of the most evenly balanced Congresses, unfortunately, in American history. This is why there is, a hope, whether or not it's a faint hope or a realistic hope, we don't know, of a new Congress that would have, a more progressive majority and perhaps even a massive Democratic majority in the Senate. That was, in fact, the case for many years, from 1932 until, with a few exceptions, literally on up into the 1970s. And it was from the 1970s that the the political support for the attacks on the Constitution began to increase after the Watergate period, and so it's we have a completely new mindset in the United States today, as opposed to the attitudes in America in the 1950s and the 1960s, when, believe it or not, the culture was much more progressive, and it was in fact a still relatively consistent with the New Deal period, which was, you know, a very great reorganization of American culture and the American economy. And I'm, you know, you as an economist, I'm certainly not going to lecture you on that, Michel.
No, absolutely. No, I of course, if we go back in U.S. history, we have periods of tremendous, I think, progress and also social, how would I say it, in a sense, a commitment on the part of, certainly on the part of the Roosevelt administration during the Great Depression to ultimately to uplift the country and to deal with pending social issues. But we certainly are no longer in that type of environment under the neoconservatives and their foreign policy and their domestic policy, I think, are consistent with one another. So, Dennis Kucinich should be joining us shortly. I haven't received any message from the station as yet. So, if we again to go back to the let's go back to the to what happened last week, the passage of this dramatic change in the FISA legislation on the foreign intelligence the Foreign Intelligence
Surveillance.
Surveillance Act. Yes, that's correct. But in this case, the issue is really one of domestic surveillance, since the reforms now more or less allow for the spying of on U.S. citizens using the telecom companies to do it. So, in fact, we are verging towards a police state apparatus. How do you view the implications of this of these changes?
Oh, they're very shocking. They're shocking from the historical perspective, certainly. And they're being justified on the basis of 9/11 and the undeniable quotient of fear and terror that has been pervasive in the American culture ever since that very fateful day. It is almost as if, you know, this is a reversal of you know, the Constitution itself, that now government, in the form of Big Brother, the Orwellian character from 1984, has the power to invade the privacy of our communications. And this is, of course, was a right that was originally constructed by the Founding Fathers when they wrote the fourth, I believe it's the fourth bill in the Bill of Rights, to security in our communications and in our homes and against unlawful searches and seizures, which of course was you know, the order of the day. It was a universal constant in the 18th century that the state, the Leviathan, had the authority to basically to seize any bit of information or any citizen at any time and any part of his property. Or her property, his property in those days. Women couldn't have property for another 100 years in Western culture. That was, of course, seen as a major right that was in was being violated systematically. And so the Constitution provided for a protection of U.S. citizens against these unlawful invasions of the rights of the public to speak privately or publicly. And it is, in fact, very disappointing that we have This legislation has been passed, as you have pointed out, very importantly, following a secret session of the United States Congress when potential legislation was obviously discussed in private, in what is supposed to be the last bastion of freedom of speech, and that's the Congress of the United States. So Americans should be very concerned that American history is taking a turn, that America is morphing into the national security state, as Dennis Kucinich announced on the floor of Congress in the statement that you have just cited.
Yeah, and I recall that back in March of this year, there was a debate in the U.S. Congress where Dennis Kucinich actually vehemently opposed the holding of these secret sessions, because he said, well, the U.S. Congress is really a place of free speech and open information and so on, and that this was not called for. And in fact, I think there have only been two or three cases in recent U.S. history where the U.S. Congress has held secret sessions. That goes back to the 1980s, and it dates to the Iran-Contra scandal.
Yes, exactly. And there were three sessions. Some of them predated Reagan. Two of them involved the situation in Nicaragua. That why Congress held secret sessions back then, for purposes trivial as that, I have no idea. Except we had no idea at the time, but of course later we found out about the Iran-Contra scandal, which was, you know, an abominable scandal, which is still not understood by the average American. That there was in fact a very vast conspiracy that originated in the National Security Council and in the presence of both the president and the vice president of the United States, Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., to have a secret arms deal with the revolutionary government of Iran during a period of war between Iraq and Iran, that America had encouraged Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, of course, to attack Iran because of the change in the regime change from the Shah to the revolutionary government of Iran. And so America was actually prosecuting a secret conspiracy to sell arms to Iran, who desperately needed arms, and take that money and divert it to give it to a very harsh paramilitary organization operating in Nicaragua against the government, against the legitimate elected government in Nicaragua, the one that was recognized by the United States and the United Nations. And this, of course, was a violation of international law.
There was another aspect to that. So it was the use of the proceeds of these arms sales to Iran under the Iran-Contra deal, and then they used this to finance the Contra directed against the elected government of Nicaragua. But what is not always mentioned is that part of those proceeds were also used to finance Al-Qaeda, namely the Mujahideen in Afghanistan at the time. But in fact, that organization was subsequently known as Al-Qaeda. It was the Islamic Brigade. So the Islamic Brigades were also financed in the same way. And that was never really mentioned in the whole debate on the Iran-Contra scandal.
Exactly. These were very bad policies at the time they were taken in the 1980s. Let's point out it's during the Reagan administration, and that was a time during which, uniquely in American history at that point, the president was not responsible for the national security agenda of the United States. That power was formally conferred on the vice president. That was George Bush Sr. It was conferred in an announcement made by, at the time, Presidential Press Secretary James Brady in March of 1981, only 5 weeks after Ronald Reagan's inauguration, that henceforward the vice president, instead of the president, would preside over meetings and functions of the National Security Council. And it was explained that the reason this decision was being taken by President Reagan was because the vice president had been director of Central Intelligence. So it was the beginning of an entire era when secret subterfuge was and covert operations was beginning to replace foreign policy, and that is part of a historical process which eventuated in the Bush doctrine of preemptive war and the appalling situation that America finds itself in today.
Michael, to get back to the spy bill, okay,
yes.
Or to the what do some people call the FISA compromise, which was a bipartisan consensus because the
yes.
Democrats ultimately supported it.
Yes.
Now, what does this mean concretely? It means that the government or the U.S. administration can spy on its citizens without any kind of constraint. Can it spy on anybody? Are there certain constraints attached to this? From what I understand, is that this is a far-reaching change, and it essentially establishes a police state in America.
Well, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is a complex piece of legislation, and I'm not an expert on it. And since we're hoping to be joined by Congressman Kucinich soon, I think he is going to have a much more information available than I will have for you. It is a form of warrantless domestic wiretapping, which in and of itself is cause for concern. Of course, it is being justified as necessary in order to inhibit and to detect the operations of terrorists. There is, of course, a FISA court that will enable the request for surveillance warrants by the federal police agencies against foreign suspected intelligence agents inside the United States. And so there are, there is a veneer, a thin veneer of control over this new awesome power of the United States to inspect the communications, telecommunications of its citizens. Of course, the defenders of the act would say that the act is not designed to intercept the routine correspondence and telecommunications of the citizens of America, but it is designed to intercept the telecommunications of foreign hostile agents to the U.S. To the United States, and so that's the justification for it. The fears surrounding it involve the powers of technology to invade our lives, our email communications or our telecommunications, and what will happen next. So will ultimately this legislation serve as a launching platform for a domestic intelligence surveillance act? That's the thing. And then how far will that extend into the lives and livelihoods of our citizens?
But I interpret this as a domestic surveillance act. I mean, it allows essentially allows the telecoms, AT&T, Sprint, Nextel, Verizon, to actually spy on U.S. citizens on behalf of the administration, and then to transfer that information to in other words, it's also the privatization of the process of spying. It's not spying which is undertaken by an entity or agency of government. It is entrusted to these companies, and I presume these companies are also billing the administration for these services which they're providing. Is that not the case? I'm not exactly clear how it's implemented. Does it go through Homeland Security, or is there any particular agency which is overseeing this and linking up with the telecom companies?
You're raising very good questions here, and I mean, I don't know of anyone who's in control of that, of the answers to them. It could well be that these are, in fact, services that will have to be billed to the U.S. taxpayer. In other words, the U.S. taxpayer would have to finance the surveillance on domestic telecommunications. Yes, I think the answer is almost certainly yes. I don't know that there's been any trade-off. The legislation, of course, exonerated the telecommunications executives from any criminal prosecution for surveillance that they had already conducted prior to the passage of the latest bill of FISA, or FISA, actually. And so there are many dimensions that raise very serious concerns about the impact of this new Orwellian legislation.
It's just an interruption. I thought we had Dennis Kucinich on the line, but it seems like, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I think that perhaps he has been delayed in his meetings. I know that he's in his constituency now. But in any event, what we'll do, this is a fascinating discussion. We'll continue with our debate. I recall a few years ago, when they had, under the auspices of Homeland Security, they had what were called the top-off, anti-terror exercises. These were drills which were implemented in various U.S. cities, and they were implemented in Canada and Britain. They were called top-off. Top-off stands for top officials. They were people from the private sector, government, FBI, municipalities, who were involved in anti-terror exercises, simulations of a possible terror attack on the United States, in the sort of 9/11. Post-9/11 context. But what was interesting in the terms of reference of these top-off exercises was that Homeland Security identified three categories of enemies. One were the terrorists. It was assumed that these were Islamic terrorists. The second were called disgruntled employees, quote-unquote, namely people who weren't happy with their work environment, and the third were called radical groups. And these two additional categories were mentioned in the documents, and it suggested, of course, that they were also considered to be enemies of America, although they, in their practice of internal forms of dissent, either against their working conditions or in anti-war demonstrations and so on. In other words, would these changes in the FISA legislation in effect go after other categories of people who are not directly a threat to the security of the United States of America, but may be involved in acts of internal dissent against the impending national security state?
Well, I think that that's exactly the fear that is being aroused by the passage of FISA. And the three groups you mentioned, of course, you know, there are the international terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, et cetera. Then you mentioned disgruntled employees. Well, there has been a very sad and mysterious phenomenon taking place in America that's sometimes reduced to the vernacular jargon of going postal. Have you heard of this, Michelle?
No. you mean going back to the U.S. mail? Is that it? Or
going postal? Yes, because several in very sad situations, disgruntled employees of the U.S. Postal Service have become so emotionally disturbed that they have gone to their place of work armed, and then they have just taken shotguns or guns and start killing their fellow employees indiscriminately. And so that is a phenomenon of American culture, virtually unique here because of our gun laws and the other dimensions of our culture. And so but the reason that was included and that it is raising antennae is because, you know, if you have to, surveilling a group, a foreign intelligence, a foreign group, well, there's going to be language, there are going to be many people involved, it's going to be very easy to identify them. But if you have to surveil people who might potentially go postal and, you know, go to either, you know, their employer or whether it's the, you know, a federal agency like the U.S. Postal Service or perhaps a defense contractor, then that is a much broader and deeper authority to invade the privacy of American citizens. And then the final category you mentioned was radical groups. I mean, what is a radical group? During the 1960s and 70s in the Nixon administration, there was a program called COINTELPRO, when the U.S. government, through the FBI and other security agencies, in fact, conducted surveillance on, you know, student groups and, you know, just basically political groups who were opposed to U.S. government policy. So those are the dimensions of the FISA Act that raise a lot of concern in the United States, and that's why there has been a great deal of opposition to the passage of FISA. I haven't seen any accurate polls, but I would like to see some. I'd like to see some definitive polls on the attitudes of Americans to the FISA.
Yeah, just to get back to this categorization of foreign and domestic enemies, I have in front of me some of the documents. It was called Emergency Preparedness Against the So-Called Universal Adversary. They don't say who he is. And then they say there are three potential categories of conspirators: foreign terrorists, domestic radical groups, they also say state-sponsored adversaries, okay, which would be the rogue states or the unstable nations, and then disgruntled employees. In fact, there are four categories. Now, the disgruntled employees, I would translate that as labor and union activists. If you're conducting surveillance in America under FISA, this particular category of individuals who are identified in these scenarios as a threat to the security of America would be categorized, I guess it would be labor and union activists whom we're talking about. And then the domestic radical groups would be anti-war civil rights groups. Essentially, if the FISA legislation is applied across the board in the United States, it could go after anybody who disagrees with the Bush administration, who considers that the war is illegal, or that the Bush administration has committed crimes, and so on and so forth. So that is, of course, the underpinning that this particular type of legislation would, in effect, initially annul any form of dissent, including the issues raised by Congressman Kucinich, namely the 35 articles of impeachment, which demonstrate the fact that the Bush administration, the president, the vice president, and many of his entourage have committed criminal acts, and that is carefully documented. So the two things, I view the two things as very carefully interrelated: the passage of these changes to the FISA legislation on the one hand, and the articles of impeachment on the other. They block any form of dissent, because if people are being spied on throughout America, of course that means their civil rights are also at stake. I'm not sure. It looks like we're getting to the end of the hour. And unfortunately, I haven't had any word from the studio on the availability of Dennis Kucinich. But I guess at this particular juncture, he must be tremendously busy in facing a number of very important issues. And while we regret that he's not on our program, we'll continue. I think at this late moment, it's almost only five more minutes left, and I haven't heard from the studio as to whether he is able to join us or not. But this has been a fascinating discussion with Michael Carmichael, who knows Dennis Kucinich, who in effect has provided us a complete background on many of these important issues. Michael, another issue in the news today, in the news, well, almost every day, but over the weekend, is Iran. And I saw that in the British newspapers, they're now saying, and that's, it sounds like disinformation, they're saying that Iran is preparing to attack the United Kingdom of Great Britain.
No, I hadn't heard that. That's shocking.
It's in the Daily Telegraph. It's in the Daily Telegraph. It's actually what they say is that they don't say that they're going to actually bomb but they say that their Hezbollah cells in Great Britain and that they're going to activate these cells which are working for Iran, and they're going to attack Great Britain. So essentially, it's a way of turning things upside down and presenting Iran as the threat rather than the other way around. I don't seem to have reference to the document right now, but that's in the press more or less on the weekend. And then you have also in Paris now, I think another important, these important meetings between the French president on the one hand, President Sarkozy on the one hand, and head of state of Syria, Assad, sorry, yes, who is now being, in fact, confronted by Sarkozy into essentially, I would say, softening its position or changing its position vis-à-vis Tehran. They're trying to change the structure of political alliances, which, of course, I think is very dangerous, because if Syria and Iran break up, then this opens up a new scenario. How do you view we have about two more minutes before the end of this program. How do you view the ongoing situation regarding Iran?
Well, my view is that it's a very dangerous and trepidatious period of time, particularly complicated because of the presidential election in the United States. And the willingness of the Bush White House and the political campaign strategies of people like Karl Rove to marshal foreign policy in the form of unjust wars to achieve a political objective. And so I think that you're absolutely right that this is something that should be a very great concern to every American citizen.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. This has been a fascinating discussion. We send our greetings to Dennis Kucinich. It's unfortunate he hasn't been on the program.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.